So, in a sense, closely, why did I do that with the map? I guess it doesn't matter as much. Because, honestly, all this happens. You could accuse the guy I'm about to talk about of doing the same thing Muhammad did, in a sense. I'm not looking at a map. This is a no-look map draw. So it's like this, you know, Spain. It's more like, some kind of a, oh, that's horrible. Look at that. There's Italy, yeah. And then, you know, get the idea. Hey, it's not bad. And then there's like one Viking ship, and they'll come in later. I'll show you. There's like a skull and crossbones. Like a big witch's brew on board. Anyway. Spear. Okay, they'll come back into it. Yeah, it's England right there. And so, I'll show you. That'll come in after. Okay. The Franks and the papacy build a fictional empire. With East and West now dividing more and more, the West itself is dividing between the Romance languages and the Germanic tongues. The era of the First Crusade would also bring to the surface, and we'll talk about that in a future week, a division that's already at the bottom of the barrel, and that was between the Frankish and the Teutonic. So we're going to talk about the East and West dividing, I think, next week. There's a division which allowed the Muslims to come in and so on. But really, there's already an inherent division in Europe, and Rome takes a place in it as well. The Germans actually saw the Pope as a bigger enemy to their future than the infidels of the East, and they refused to join in the fight in the Holy Land once that had come up. The tribes that stretch from what was at that time called, sometimes it was called Franklin, sometimes Francia. So that was pretty much right there, and of course it was still commonly referred to as Hispania down there in Britannia and so on and so forth. And all those lands in between, over here to the east, were divided up by, remember, those barbarian invasions that we talked about last week. But at about this time, we don't know exactly when, but at least by the 4th, 5th, 6th century, villagers, tribal chieftains, and it's probably the one thing they had partially more right than the Romans. You almost have to wonder where they got the idea from. They would assemble in the woods and celebrate their constitutional privileges, sort of sometimes these annual festivals. And they would assert this over the will of their kings. Such rites would be celebrated at annual assemblies during the transition from the initial Frankish dynasty to the second and most important that we're going to talk about. Remember that guy Clovis we talked about? 6th century. He was one of the first in a line that really built this empire and made war against the Arians and sort of drove them further eastward. And that was one dynasty. Anyway, these guys were really putting into practice something that had really come through general revelation, the first and essential piece of the biblical doctrine of civil dominion. It was already widely recognized by this time. Namely, that the earthly magistrate, is what we'd call him later, derives his authority entirely from God and is therefore subject to God's rule. Now, when this came to the monarchy, it implied that the monarch is a lower sovereign, so immediately it's going to get twisted. He's utterly sovereign over his subjects, but is utterly submitted to the sovereign of all the universe. So there was this tension in their early thinking. But the trouble comes when the only sovereign you can see, namely the earthly king, gets to interpret that civil dominion. The king then delegated a measure of his unquestioned authority to his nobles or his counts to enforce this reign. These counts would enlist those on their lands or manors to fight in their little armies as knights. This was not seen as the same thing as an oppressive kind of statism, since there wasn't really much money in circulation anyway, and therefore the counts bore the cost of the local domain and armies. Everything was under God, yet all was under the king, and then his nobles executed by the force of his knights. So this is the root of what became feudalism. It was a blurry biblical doctrine made to fit the ancient regime and bearing the natural traits of the secular doctrine that would become collectivist economics. It's sort of a natural way to think about dividing up resources. But the king got it started. I mean, their question was in the 8th century, the economy was entirely agricultural, and the land was entirely gained by conquest. And so in their minds, they were thinking, well, who conquers but the king? Who allocates resources? Who do we owe the gaining of resources to but the king, the tribal chieftain? In this way, we can say that a statist view of economics is a natural animal-like expectation of the simple servile mind. Resources are only obtained by force, and those who wield this force then dispense the land according to the nebulous concept of the general welfare. Only a few little beams of light were really shining through from the whole biblical view of man. Dominion and labor would be something that had to be articulated throughout this era, but you do see the first fruits of it at this time. So let's get to these particular kings that start to create the Holy Roman Empire. You might remember this, I don't know if you do or not, depending on if you were here, but that guy Clovis, he was really toward the beginning of a dynasty called the Merovingians. But by this time, they'd become a bunch of do-nothings. And so there was another group that were pretty much mayors of the palace. But they were the ones that were really organizing the empire at that time, because that was the biggest center, the biggest manor. And so they were made the mayors of the place. And that was that guy I told you about before, Charles Martel, that stopped the Moorish advance in 732 at the Battle of Tours. And they were called the Carolinian. So I'm going to erase these guys already. The Carolinian dynasty. I probably got that backwards. I did. Spelled like that. The G after the N. And that name is after the Latin for descendants of Charles, Caroligni, namely Charles Martel. Charles's dates are 686 to 741. And again, he's the one that led the military of the Franks in their decisive victory at the Battle of Tours, which put a stop to the Muslim advance northward into Europe. He turned down the Pope's offer to name him consul and lived out his days as Duke and Prince of the Franks. So again, these were mayors of the palace land, but they did the real bulk of the governing. The Merovingians were not doing much ruling. They were being called at that time the do-nothing kings. So the son of Charles, Pepin the Short, love these names, Charles the Bald. In fact, little-known fact about Pepin, the mother of Charlemagne, who we're going to talk about, Pepin got a wife named doesn't matter. It's not Bernice. It's like Bernice. Doesn't matter. She was nicknamed Bigfooted Bertha. Yeah. So, affectionately, though.
Yeah.
Because, anyway. Charles the Bald. What the heck? We'll get to him. Pepin the Short. Oh. Well, he brought his complaint to Pope Zachary at that time, and at first the Pope is like, I can't make you the king. You know, that's, Samuel anoints David. They have that concept. We anoint this person, but I can't do that because that's God's anointed, and I don't have any... Well, eventually he agreed. And he put a theological rationale to the change in royalty, arguing that one has lost his dominion if he doesn't exercise it. You, in a sense, you've lost your right through immoral... unbiblical. So whether the Pope is thinking it or not, he's doing this out of convenience. He's beginning to put into practice what would become the Christian idea of the design of the state and the recourse that the people have. And ironically, this was roughly the same argument that John Wycliffe would later use in the 14th century against the automatic perpetuity of any temporal dominion, not just the state, but the church. In other words, after Adam, you could lose your dominion as a result of not acting according to the design. And that's part of what Paul had in mind in Romans 13, usually the part we don't look at. We like to, as modern pietists, it was different 20 years ago, but now we're all embarrassed by the moral majority and we're self-hating Westerners, even though we don't like to say it like that. And mean people like me have to say that and do a psychological profile of our effeminate mindset. But we're a bunch of self-hating Westerners. And so when we read Romans 13... we read it as a blank check to the state. And we typically look at the decretal language of Romans 13 and not at the design language of Romans 13. Paul's using both. In other words, God not only decrees who's in office, but he designs the essence or the nature of the office. Both are taught in Romans 13, which implies that you always submit to the office, but you frequently kill the tyrant. Modern effeminate Christians prefer, for the same reason that these people welcome the Arabs in, to only read one half of that and turn it into a blank check. The Pope would start to, Pope Zachary, would use that as a rationale for anointing Pepin the Short. But Wycliffe would use that in the 14th century. We'll get later to that in church history too. That any temporal dominion, including the church, could lose that dominion as a result of that kind of behavior. In any event, Pepin was anointed by the local Archbishop Boniface in 752, acting as the Pope's representative, in a practice that would recall the prophets of Israel anointing the chosen monarch. This would complete the Roman vision of the church standing over the state in terms of secular authority. And that's another point. They're not just separate spheres. The church is the only of the institutions that's of the new creation. It stands over the institutions of the old creation. You already saw that in Ambrose and Augustine with the city of God. And so in Genesis 1 and 2, you have Adam and Eve, in a sense, told, multiply, dominate, cultivate, know, and name, which creates the four different institutions of human society, namely the state, the family, labor, and education and the sciences. All of civilization is commanded of Adam and Eve in this social mandate. The church as the new creation stands over that. The church is the only institution that is eternal. It doesn't stand over it as a king. It stands over it as a prophet. It speaks to these spheres and tells them what their design is. And so the Pope is carrying out that vision of Ambrose and Augustine and others, and he's putting it into practice by anointing Pepin. Now, the Pope himself would anoint him a second time in 754 in exchange for the armies of Pepin, who would make a war against the Lombards in Italy and force them to surrender what they'd previously taken from Catholics. And this really placed the Roman Church in total political control of their surroundings for the first time. So notice, though they're articulating this biblical doctrine, they are immediately doing it for secular money-grubbing purposes. Which immediately, if you don't have a discerning mind, you see one happening. And you see, that's what happens when the church starts to talk about money or politics or armies, is you start to, who's you and what are we talking about? Is it true or not? You don't judge God's word by how it has been distorted. You can't call a line crooked unless you have the idea of a straight line. That's irrational, blasphemous nonsense. You're accusing the designer of making a bad design. In fact, the agreement was made to the next pope, Stephen II, who requested a strip of land. He was asking the Frankish king to help him. A strip of land in Italy that would run from Ravenna all the way to the other side of Rome. Let me just demonstrate what this looks like on the modern map. Kind of like this, like a belt. A little bit crooked, but focused up toward the northeast in Ravenna. That would come to be known as the Papal States, from sea to sea of the Italian peninsula. And Pepin delivered that. He did drive the Lombards up north and out of there. And he would spend the rest of his days driving what remained of the Moorish occupants back south into Spain. Yet for all of that, the second Carolinian, Pepin, and the first to be recognized across Europe, really doesn't concern us that much. Who does is Charlemagne. Let me spell that for you if you don't have the notes. And that is just a combination of the French, which, remember, comes from Latin. Magnus, speaking of names, Albertus Magnus. We'll talk about him in a future. The Great. That's a better name than Charles the Short. But that's what's happening here. Charles the Great in the Latin, but as it's smoothed out into the French, Charles Magne, Charles the Great. He was actually born out of wedlock. Sorry, his dates are 742 to 814. Born out of wedlock. Remember, Bigfoot with Bertha. That's but and Pepin had to marry her 6 years later to make that legitimate. And so at the beginning of these, remember, these are tribal chieftains before this, before they really start to get civilized. And so they're still kind of practicing like tribal chieftains where they're getting civilized. Okay? Now, Charles the Great was also great in size as well. 6'4", as the examination of his skeleton in the 19th century showed, which is pretty good for a Frenchman. Oh, that's right. I commitment to... well, at the time, 6'4", And that's like Yao Ming of France. 6'4". They do an examining his skull. His skeleton. It's a little creepy. Anyway, he was educated in the palace school that had already been established, so it was a mistake to think that there was no life of the mind prior to what would eventually become his intellectual projects. His formal education has even been set in the context of some rudimentary form of what we're going to look at, the trivium and quadrivium. I might have mentioned it once or twice. Let me just do it because we're going to come to it when we get to Alcium anyway. Right before you speak. You know, I really should have put the trivium on the bottom as a foundation, but you'll get the idea, the imagery. Again, right before you speak. There you go, that's an I, that's why. Okay. This just means way of three, or three roads, tri, via. Quadrivium just means way of four, or four roads. And so what this is the classical way of educating, going all the way back to the Greek world, of three stages of development for a child, called grammar, logic, and rhetoric, which mirrors right before you speak. Whatever, I didn't care. Once you scribble it up that much, you just forget where you are and everything. Grammar, logic, these are stages that actually mirror the progression, the nature of a child's soul. They're sponges at first. You indoctrinate them. Oh, that's horrible. That's imperialistic. Oh, shut up. You do the same thing where you are in the plantation school system. Logic just synthesizes that information. And rhetoric teaches them. Now, if you just teach them rhetoric at the beginning with all this stuff, boom, you got Hitler. You got yourself a really good PR guy that can dominate other people and stuff like that. And so it's supposed to go in that order. By the time they get to college, which at that time was often by age 13, 14, or 15, because they, at the beginning of their life, they just thought all day and hunted. They thought and hunted. They learned this stuff. And this wasn't so much a progression so much as it was astronomy covering the whole motions. And these, some of these are just shorthands. Regular mathematics. Geometry. So you have discrete mathematics dealing with finite points, numbers, versus, in a sense, spatial mathematics. I can't possibly get into the distinction how they were thinking like Plato there. And then music, which is also a form of form. But I can't get into any of that because everything in the modern world bucks against that, and I don't have time to justify it. But that's another class. But Charlemagne was sort of a primitive form of that. He spoke German, explicitly. Don't forget, Germanic origins to these people. His Latin was fluid, and I meant to say he spoke only some Greek. Okay, so he spoke mainly German. When his father died, remember Pepin, he died in 768. He basically had two sons, Pepin did, and Charlemagne was not the favorite. Carloman was, so he received the majority of the inheritance, but that was okay because 3 years later Carloman died. And so the whole land was left to Charlemagne. And the whole land essentially means this. All the way over to, you know, Burgundia was sort of its own place, and then the Saxons were on the frontier. They were the real wild men, and now that's where they came from. And so Charlemagne, in a sense, had a design to Christianize them. Now, see, when he does that, it's imperialism. But when Islam does it, it's called a sport. The favorite sport of Arabian males at that time, by liberals. Charlemagne had a war on three fronts, really. There was a continuation of the expelling of the Lombards in Italy. So here's one front. By the way, don't forget, these are from, it was them and the Ostrogoths that were in northern Italy, and the dominant form of Christianity among them was Arianism. So he's driving them out, and so the last flickering flames of Arianism are still there. And then there was this sort of momentary Cold War with the Muslims and their courts to the south. They weren't in open warfare most of the time. And they were in part of southern France. And then thirdly, the more open war and most frequent war with the Germanic Saxons to the east. So that was his war on three fronts. Unless you want to count the Vikings. Their shores would constantly be raided by Vikings. from Scandinavian lands, and these are really the only guys on the near the continent that were not Christian. They worshipped who's Thor and who's the other dude?
Odin.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you've watched the movies.
But anyway, they believed that these gods had given to them the conquest of Europe. The problem was, well, it wasn't a problem, but in their minds, by the way, they settled here, and a lot of them they remained uncivilized here. I'm going to say it. That explains a lot. I mean this in a nice way. This is not a crack against Britain, because eventually they got very civilized, and church history is very much going to focus on a refined form of Christianity there eventually. So it's not a knock against them at all. But the Scandinavian people were settling in Russia. They would eventually become these Normandy people. We'll get to them, the Norman invasions, the people that would go there. They would eventually become civilized, but they did not conquer the land, the Vikings. They were just there for the stuff, for the one of my favorite words in all of history and economics, booty. Every single page. Anyway, they were there just for the stuff. All right? For the food. And that's another, even favoriter word. Food stuff. You ever read that in history books? Like, that really? That's the best you could do? Food stuff? Seriously, that's what they call it. Anyway, so they came just for that stuff. They were not conquering land. They were there. They came, they saw, and they left. And so there was never really... Now, when they did get on the land, the mounted cavalry of the French could beat them. But when it came to these... Why? The French! Did I use an oxymoron? A French war hero? Sorry. Was that what you're laughing at? I did not mean any... I'm not making fun of the French at all. It's just that on the Craigslist the other day, I saw this ad for a French musket, and it said... Sorry, I'm not going to go there. Never used. Fired only once and left on the ground. Never mind. There's a lot of jokes there. Anyway, I'll erase that. Vikings. There's nothing much more to say about them. It wasn't really a war in the same sense. The Vikings were really Europeans' first terrorists at that time. And like I said, they eventually settled down after a couple of centuries. And in fact, one of their chiefs, Rollo, would be granted the land known to history as Normandy at the beginning of the 10th century. So eventually it would sort of become integrated by Christian culture to some extent. After these two popes, Stephen I and Stephen II, had lost much of what they gained from the Lombards, a new pope, Hadrian, for some books it spells it Adrian, doesn't really matter, Hadrian, they mean the same guy, Adrian the First, had come to Charlemagne to renew the Frankish commitment in 773, namely their commitment to defend Rome and uphold them, to be the great protectors of the Roman Empire. That really hadn't existed since Constantine, and since before the empire was fractured. But from this struggle would emerge, for the future of the church, the bulk of what concerns us about this earthly monarchy. This is really why it matters. This was a strong pope. And he threatened excommunication of anybody who joined those who would attempt to seize the papal state. So he's threatening excommunication to the Lombards. And this spiritual ploy seemed to work, and many defected and joined the ranks of Charlemagne. So they finally put down their forces in June of 774. But it was during this next season, the middle years of the 770s, that King Charles the Great would read the great works of the Christian era. At this point, Charlemagne's still becoming Christianized in a sense. He would be given a gift from the Pope, Hadrian, basically the whole canon law of the church. And then, at that same time, in about 775, he would read Augustine's classic work, The City of God. And that would really put the final stamp on what he felt called to do with his reign. Charlemagne refused to see this vision of Augustine's as simply some ethereal or inapplicable story that had no connotations and no contact with this present age. Whoever was in a position to do so, Charlemagne thought, should at least try to impose as much of this heavenly order on the earthly state of affairs as possible. And who is in a better position to do that than the most powerful monarch in Europe? Now, it might be said that Charlemagne was as guilty for doing to the Saxons what Caliph Omar had done to Persia, Syria, and Egypt. Certainly Charles was not yet well taught in matters of faith, and so there's no excusing his secular approach. So I don't want you to hear that this is some triumphant story of the opposite of what Caliph Omar did. But motives aside, the Saxons were brought into the fold. Many of their nobles were invited to massive German-style feasts where they would hear preaching, actually, and many of them would be baptized. So, in a sense, Charlemagne was having, I was going to call them missional small groups, but that would be bending the bounds of credulity. But he would have these massive feasts on the frontier with the Saxons where preaching would happen. Now, you're still going to call that imperialistic because, of course, they had to be forced to go to these feasts because they'd already been conquered. But he wanted to extend goodwill to them and did so by spreading the Christian message, trying to Christianize them. Now, the other providential thing happening at this time that allowed all of this to take place was that the Arab Empire was split between different caliphs at the same time. So there was the leadership of the descendants of Muhammad's uncle, called the Abbasids, who were not as hell-bent as the Umayyad caliphate was in running all over Europe. And so one of their own was in charge at this time. And Pepin had already begun diplomatic relations with them. And so now Charles would do the same in 778 when he agreed with them to drive down into Spain, and the Arabs would, who were in control there but not in Spain, would pledge even their Arab support with support from other people in Europe, with the Franks, so it's sort of a three, like an ally powers against the Moors to drive them back even possibly out of Spain. So you help us, you scratch our back over here, diplomatically, with trade and stuff like that, and we will take our forces, in a sense, out of Europe. Okay? But it didn't work. This help never arrived. And they were all divided and everything, and the Franks had very little success and were driven out. And in fact, one of the classics of medieval literature, the Song of Roland, was sort of a spin on the defeats at that time. And so they were further driven out of there. By the way, another thing in books at that time, you're going to hear Muslims referred to as the Saracens. That just means Arabs, if you see that. Let's learn to spell. By that time, these Saracens had cut off supply lines of papyrus from the Middle East. Here's another connection to what Charlemagne ultimately does. And so therefore, parchment from sheepskin was the only source for intellectual output. Writing became expensive and naturally declined. And so anything that was not deemed absolutely necessary for the running of the state was seen as wasteful. Classical Latin went into decline, as much as Greek had originally. And therefore, a rough form only was practiced. Unlike so many other overlord-type sovereigns, Charlemagne saw the potential disaster that would come from this. So as blundering as his military campaigns were, his aim was increasingly turning to the triumph of the word. And that brings in that guy that I mentioned very briefly, Alcuin, who is comes from the sort of an Anglo. Remember the Angles were there with the Saxons as well. This guy's name is Alcuin. And his dates are 735 to 804. He was the man who would lead Charlemagne's intellectual revolution. He was born in York, and yet he was brought to the palace school of Charlemagne that would wind up as the master of the abbey in Tours, which Martin dreamed up as his intellectual armory. We talked about monasticism last time. Hopefully you've listened to that if you weren't here. During his earliest teaching at the school in York, Alcuin would write and implement the most developed institutional Christian form of those things over there, the trivium and the quadrivium. This shows a rigorous idea of the university as early as the 8th century. During a trip to Rome as a legal envoy in 781, he would run into Charlemagne, though not for the first time. So in the course of conversation, it was becoming clear to him that the Lord was calling him to this larger stage of the king's court. Alcuin was brought into the palace school the next year, for the most part, to train up missionaries for the Saxon frontier. So here's a king specifically forming what we would now recognize as a part seminary, part university. And he was also training up his own two sons for the court as well. The liberal arts were now imported among the Franks, where they had not been before. And the effect spread even to the issue of gospel toleration. Alcuin would actually challenge the law that Charlemagne put into effect that would enforce baptism. And therefore, supposedly, enforce conversion. So at that point, Charlemagne still had the same view that Constantine did. So he taught the king, quote, that faith is a free act of the will, not a forced act. We must appeal to the conscience, not compel it by violence. You can force people to be baptized, but you cannot force them to believe. So the king repealed the death penalty for pagans at once. Though for a time the death penalty was enacted for anybody breaking their fast during Lent. Interestingly, it's during Lent right now, so you would be executed for most of what you're doing, just to let you know. After a very brief return home, Charlemagne put him to work, Alcuin, of fighting off various heresies arising from the south. So Christians of the south never quite shook off their Arian heritage, nor would they find any suitable response to the Muslims than a form of adoptionism. So this sort of repackaged form of adoptionism that was put down in the 4th and the 5th century is re-emerging, and Charlemagne is aware of it, understands what's wrong with it, and Alcuin is put in charge of stamping out that heresy. So he represented the Orthodox at the council in Frankfurt in 794. So this guy Alcuin moves to that abbacy, it was called, at Tours. I don't know why I put all those lines here. All those are getting in the way. So you kind of have the king's palace, and you also have this seminary that was really run out of this monastery in Tours. And so he would be in charge of that until he died 5 years later. Monasteries, what were they doing in there? They were multiplying texts at record efficiency, all of them still in Latin, of course. Alcuin replaced the diverse and the sloppy script of the Western tribes with what became known as Carolinian minuscule. Basically, large, computer font-like neatness, kind of things that makes a font Nazi like me very happy. Square letters that replaced this sloppy script from before. Why it was called minuscule is kind of weird, because it was big face. But Charlemagne insisted upon it because he perceived a close connection between legibility of print and intelligibility of concepts. It is said that, quote, 90% of our earliest examples of Latin classical writing are Carolinian copies. But it would be the project given by the king to Alcuin that would be the first mass critical translation of the Bible. The effort of Erasmus later on in 1513 was not the first of its kind. Neither, incidentally, was that of Alcuin. We've already seen critical compilations of people like Tatian, Origen, and Jerome. But at any rate, the court in France was well aware of the proliferation of copyist errors. The mending of these in one pure text was the whole point of this project that he gave to Alcuin. And so he finished his work just in time for Christmas of 800. It would be a gift that would coincide with Charlemagne's ascent to the power of the new consolidated empire. And this was the moment that many historians regard to be the genesis of a uniquely European Western civilization. And so on Christmas Day, 800, Charlemagne was crowned by Pope Leo III as the monarch of both the Franks and the whole expanse of the Christian Roman Empire. So this is different than when Boniface had anointed Pepin. He did so of the Franks, recognizing them as a province, in a sense, in the Catholic order. But what Leo was doing, and people debate whether or not Leo was more behind it or Charlemagne, they were both angling for things, is he was making Charlemagne, in a sense, what used to be regarded as the Caesar of the what would become the Holy Roman Empire, a Christian Roman Empire. That was the idea. And you always hear those jokes today that the Holy Roman Empire was neither holy nor Roman nor an empire. Discuss. That's like one of those things that on that Saturday Night Live skit. Here's a topic for you. You know, that's sort of one of those things. But it's true. It was none of those three things. And I think at some level they understood that as well. Now, Charles could have deposed Leo at that time, and he was pretty close to doing it. But at the advice of Alcuin and others, such an alliance would increase the prestige of both offices all over Europe and really would, you know, drive out a lot of the divisions that had existed before that time. So this would be the closest that Charlemagne would come to realizing the unity and peace of his idea of the city of God. So he became convinced in that last year of the 8th century. And he received this title of Imperator Augustus. It was given to him in this service in St. Peter's Basilica. So this crowning was going on in St. Peter's Basilica, the main cathedral, in a sense, of the entire empire. Which, remember, basilicas were patterned after the Roman civic buildings, not pagan temples. That'd be bad too, but it was patterned after the old civil structures, the basilica. And he is given this secular church anointing at this time over the whole empire. So it's justification in his mind. He had to justify it, and the Pope had to justify it theologically as well. Its justification seemed to be that Christianity had finally outdone the pagan, even on their own secular stage. Obviously, they weren't as concerned about syncretism as much as they should be. At the most basic level, he retained the sentiments of Constantine, that the monarch acted as a protector of the church, the high priest. By the way, this still shows up in British and Scottish thought. British, you even see it in Cromwell, Lord Protector. But that idea wasn't just of the Commonwealth, but it was of the church. And in fact, the Scottish Presbyterians, I love them, but for example, Derek Thomas, J. Lincoln Duncan's right-hand man, actually kind of jokingly makes fun of the American Presbyterians that got rid of the clause in the Westminster Confession on the state that gave the whoever's in charge, the magistrate, the power to prosecute even things such as heresy. Well, that is something that was retained through British thought through Elizabeth, with the Elizabethan settlement, that the church, whether they want to say it this way or not, the state created the church. It was true in the Byzantine Empire, it's now true in the West, and it was true of England. And if the Scots had gotten their way, as much as they were independent from the Anglicans, it would have been the case as well. It took, I'm sorry, but the American Revolution, with all their deists involved, to get this theology more correct than Europe had it. Okay? So that's an important point. He retains this sentiment of Constantine that the monarch acted as the high priest. In fact, the Romans even called it Pontifex Maximus, the great high priest, which last time I checked was Jesus' title. But their idea was they were going to protect the church, at least. At least we can do that. And that's twisting a truth that they can protect from physical harm. That is the state's job. And they would decide on doctrinal error if it came to it. When the ecclesiastical councils can't make up their mind, when it might lead to civil unrest, they can step in there as well. And so he did so. He calls for a council to root out adoptionism in 794, albeit for a good cause. But he demonstrates this attitude of a secular shepherd. The same council made images in church acceptable in the West. But it was like a council in A-C-H-E-N, still there in present Germany, just over the Belgian border. But it was kind of his favorite home away from home. So in 809, there's at this council where he accepts language, this phrase, which I'll never be able to pronounce, because it's one of those words you look at and stare at, and you're like, nah, I can't do that. Filioque? I don't know. What is that? Filioque? Okay. That's what it is. I don't know. But here's what it means. In the Nicene Creed, you remember the Son proceeded from the Father, the Spirit proceeded from the Son, and so the addition of Constantinople in 381, when they were also reaffirming the deity of the Holy Spirit as well, well, they added at this council in 809 that the Holy Spirit proceeded from the Son and the Father, or the Father and the Son. Now, there's ways to show that in the Bible, by inference, at the very least. And the Eastern Church was not happy about that. And that became the beginning, the wedge of their final split 2 centuries later. But we'll come back to that. But it was interesting because it would be this Frankish court, not Rome, who would fire the last shot in the division between West and East. Now, Rome would affirm that, but I think for political reasons, not for doctrinal reasons so much. But this empire, as we come to a close, was instantly divided between the ineffectual rule of an internally declining Christian mindset. Its territories by 843 were divided into three. And summary of this building of concentration of light in the middle of the Dark Ages, which I already showed you, if you want to talk about a Dark Ages, you might talk about the mid-5th to 6th century. But it's really improper to talk about it after that, and particularly once you get to this point. And in fact, most secular historians don't do that anymore. Paul Johnson remarks in his History of Christianity that, quote, the church had given the rulers of the Western barbarians, listen to that, the church had given to the rulers of the Western barbarians. So one of the things you see right now is Islam was really in the Middle East, and the Arab world was cultivated, and they had a high culture. The West was barbaric. Well, the West was barbaric because the West was sacked by barbarians. So there's a little sleight of hand going on there. Well, Johnson gets it. He says the church had given the rulers of the Western barbarians an awareness of their classical heritage and an anxiety to preserve and transmit it almost as strong as among the men of the late empire and after, like Cassiodorus and Boethius. But of course, the inheritance was now seen entirely in a Christian context, end quote. So the church, embedded within society, illuminated the form of rationality to the barbarians who carved up the geography of the 5th through 7th centuries. So let's repeat that in a different way. Get this whole Dark Ages thing finally put behind us. Barbarian rulers from outside of both Rome or the church. Barbarian rulers from outside of Rome or outside of the church interrupted and largely destroyed classical culture, and the Christian intellect reassimilated most of this and gave it a superior unity in just 3 short centuries with little to no help from the existing infrastructure. You know, we're standing on the shoulders of giants. I mean, well, how long does it take to write an encyclopedia? Well, if you're in the woods running from a spear and, you know, trying to look for work and stuff like that, I think it would take a little bit longer than 3 centuries. And maybe psychologically they compare it to the rise of Islam, but again, Islam did what they did in 2 generations as the result of armies, not as the result of words. So in just 3 short centuries, the Christian synthesis had not only reassimilated classical culture, but gave it a superior context. The evidence for this can hardly even be called evidence. It is an indisputable fact that can only be disregarded if you try to. Our ignorance of the historical reality here as reality is a product of this systematic disregard. So let me leave it at that. The beginnings of the Holy Roman Empire, as bad of an idea as that was, that's how it got started.